Welcome to the East County Magazine Live Radio Show, the voice of East County, bringing you the hottest news and coolest events from the communities of San Diego's East County. We're your community radio, representing the public interest, not special interests. Broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso with your host, Miriam Raftery.
This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso. Today on our Capitol Report, we'll have some details for you about just what's included and what's not in the Republican health care bill, and which local representatives cast the deciding votes to pass Trump Care in the House of Representatives. Then in our agricultural report, hear about a new bill introduced in Sacramento by a local legislator to provide protection for farm workers from deportation, also helping farmers who need workers to harvest their crops in California. Our newsmaker interview today is with Amar Campanagir. He's formerly worked in the Obama administration's Labor Department and as a White House intern, as well as served on the board of the Hispanic Chamber of Commerce. He's a businessman of Hispanic and Arab descent, and now he's running for Congress as one of several Democrats seeking to win the congressional district seat currently held by Republican Congressman Duncan Hunter. We also want to invite all of you to meet award-winning journalist Amy Goodman, host of the nationally syndicated Democracy Now! Radio show. Amy Goodman has been on the forefront of covering important issues such as climate change for over 20 years, covering conferences around the world, also interviewing top scientists, writers, policymakers, activists, indigenous leaders, and academics, and giving a voice to the voiceless across America. She'll be in town this Tuesday night, May 16th, from 7 to 9 p.m. to speak and sign copies of her new book, Democracy Now!, covering the movements changing America, at a benefit for KNSJ Radio and Activist San Diego, at St. Paul's Cathedral Episcopal in San Diego. All proceeds will benefit KNSJ Radio and Activist San Diego. You can get tickets by visiting knsj.org. Now please stay tuned for today's edition of the East County Magazine Radio Show, where East County matters. This is East County Magazine's Capitol Report, bringing you the latest news and newsmakers from our nation's capital. This is Miriam Raftery with East County Magazine's Capitol Report. A bill to repeal the Affordable Care Act, also known as Obamacare, and replace it with the American Health Care Act, or Trump Care, recently passed the House of Representatives and is now awaiting action by the Senate. The bill passed by just a four-vote margin, with San Diego Republicans Duncan Hunter and Daryl Issa both voting in favor. If they had voted against it, the vote would have been tied, and the measure would not have passed, so our local legislators cast the deciding votes. The measure passed without a single Democratic vote. The vote came on President Donald Trump's 105th day in office as Republicans strive to work through reforming the American healthcare system and eliminate mandated insurance. But the measure has drawn sharp criticism from the American Medical Association, representing doctors, the American Association of Retired Persons, and other consumer advocacy groups who say the bill will hurt many patients, particularly the poor, senior citizens, disabled, and people with serious illnesses. The House voted without even waiting for a report on the amended bill from the Congressional Budget Office. Just 6 weeks earlier, the House Speaker canceled a vote on an earlier version of this bill due to lack of support, so amendments were made to satisfy the Conservative Freedom Caucus, including adding a provision that gives states the option to weaken protections for those with pre-existing conditions. The bill must now face the Senate, however, where a handful of Republicans immediately said they will reject the bill as written. Both the House and Senate must agree on the language of the bill, which could be challenging. Even before that House vote, Republican senators voiced reservations about the bill, which would roll back the expansion of Medicaid under the Affordable Care Act if it becomes law. President Donald Trump called it a great plan and insisted, yes, premiums will be coming down, yes, deductibles will be coming down. Democratic Representative Louise Slaughter of New York called the bill political suicide for Republicans who have been facing heat in town halls back in their districts after voting to repeal Obamacare, without improving protections for anyone except perhaps insurance companies. The bill would eliminate tax penalties for people who choose not to invest in health insurance. However, low-income Americans are at risk if the bill passes, for it will lower state-by-state expansions of Medicaid. The bill would offer tax credits of $2,000 to $4,000 a year, depending on age, in contrast to the government-subsidized insurance policies offered by the Affordable Care Act. A family could receive up to $14,000 a year in credits, and those credits would be less for families making over $150,000 a year and individuals making over $75,000. The bill would trim the federal budget deficit considerably by $839 billion over a decade, but at a high human cost, leaving 24 million more American people without health insurance, according to the Congressional Budget Office. It would also eliminate taxes on wealthy Americans and medical industries that were used to pay for the Affordable Care Act. Premiums would be 15 to 20% higher in 2018 and 2019, though some say they will be lower afterwards. States can seek a waiver from Obamacare's current requirement that insurers must charge people the same for coverage regardless of whether they have a pre-existing condition or not. That means that many of the sickest Americans won't be able to afford to buy health care at all when they need it the most. Dr. Lena Wen, a former emergency room physician who is now Baltimore City Health Commissioner, told NBC News, "The Trump care plan is, quote, terrifying because patients could, in essence, be priced out of coverage." The American Academy of Pediatrics also criticized the measure, stating, "The bill allows insurers to go back to putting annual and lifetime limits on coverage, meaning that a premature baby on private insurance could exceed her lifetime limit on coverage before she even leaves the hospital." A Senate date for hearing on the Republican measure is not yet set, but it is clear that senators have a monumental decision on their hands, one that could cost thousands of lives, as well as cost some legislators re-election to Congress in the 2018 election.
How you gonna keep 'em down on the farm after they seem hairy?
This is Jonathan Getz with East County Magazine's Agricultural Report. Senator Dianne Feinstein has co-authored legislation introduced last week to shield farm workers from deportation and put them on a path to earned legal status and eventual citizenship. Under the Agricultural Worker Program Act, farm workers who have worked in agriculture for at least 100 days in each of the past 2 years would be able to earn lawful blue card status if the bill is approved. Farm workers who maintain blue card status for the next 3 or 5 years, depending on the total hours worked in agriculture, would be eligible to adjust to a green card or legal permanent residency. Agriculture is a $54 billion industry in California, and UC Davis estimates that up to 70% of California farm workers, that's over 500,000 people, are undocumented. Under the Trump Justice Department's new immigration enforcement guidelines, they are all priorities for deportation. Senator Dianne Feinstein states, "Everywhere I travel in California, I hear from farmers, growers, and producers from all industries, wine, citrus, fruit, and nut trees, dairy, that there aren't enough workers. Farm labor is performed almost exclusively by undocumented immigrants." By protecting farm workers from deportation, the bill achieves two goals: ensuring that hardworking immigrants don't live in fear and that California's agriculture industry has the workforce it needs to thrive. Senator Feinstein concludes, "We simply must protect the families who help put food on our tables." The bill, which has not yet been assigned a bill number, is supported by a coalition of labor and immigrant rights groups, but it is unclear whether it will have any chance of being heard amid the anti-immigrant stances of the leaders in the Senate, which has a slim Republican majority, let alone pass the House, which is firmly controlled by conservatives who have supported President Trump's calls for mass deportations. If deportation of farm workers is not stopped, Americans across the nation can expect to pay more for fruits and vegetables that could be left to rot in the fields if not enough workers can be found to pick them.
You're listening to KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, the network for social justice.
Now, straight from the headlines, bringing you our latest top newsmakers. This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, recording at our studio in East County. And today my very special guest is Amar Campanjar. He's running against Congressman Duncan Hunter in the 50th Congressional District. Amar is a Democrat who served as the Public Affairs Officer for the U.S. Department of Labor in the Obama administration. He's a native of San Diego, of Hispanic and Arab descent. He has also served as Director of Communications and Marketing for the U.S. Hispanic Chamber of Commerce. He was a White House intern, and he's worked with nonprofits as well as his church, he's a Christian, on issues ranging from helping deported veterans to supporting working people. Mar, welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you for having me. I'm happy to be here.
So, what made you decide to run for Congress?
You know, this journey started maybe 5 years ago when I was the field director for the Obama campaign. And I saw thousands of people who volunteered their labor and love in advocacy of a common cause. And I got to see how noble people worked in the name of their common humanity. And were it not for all those hardworking people, I would not have the opportunity to pursue my dreams, to go serve in the White House, and to do the things that I was able to do. So I'm coming back to give back to the community that's given me everything, that's allowed me to achieve my dreams, and I want to help them achieve theirs. And I really believe, you know, this is a where were you moment in the life of our country. People will look back at this moment and ask, where were you when people were literally fighting for their lives? They were fighting for their constitutional rights. They were fighting for their health care. And I think we know where Duncan Hunter's been on the fight for health care.
Yes, at his town hall meeting, he was very clear about that. He said, I do not believe health care is a right. Mm. I believe in access. And, of course, one of his constituents stood up and said, well, I have access to a first-class seat on a plane, but it doesn't matter if I can't afford it. And he really didn't have an answer to that. So he did vote for the Republican health care bill, which the Congressional Budget Office has said will take health care away from 24 million people and, you know, among other things. Mm. So, Amar, let me ask you this, though. This is a very red district. Mm. It has a heavily Republican registration. What makes you believe that you, having worked in the Obama administration, are the best candidate to win over those crossover votes that are absolutely vital in this district for a Democrat to win?
That's a great question. And I think, you know, going back to this as being a where were you moment for our country, I've been spending every single waking moment in this election, in this race, talking to people. Mm-hmm. You know, we've gotten a lot of good national coverage, but this election is not about the newsroom. It's about people's dining rooms. It's about their living rooms. I've been spending all of my time there at protests, at rallies, at VFWs and town halls, listening and learning, mm-hmm. which is something that every elected official mm-hmm. better be doing. And a lot of people aren't. And I think Duncan Hunter is not listening. Yeah. But what I'm hearing is people are saying, I'm an illness away from losing my home. I'm hearing from a veteran who said he had to sell his computer just to get his medicine this month. I talked to a mother who said, I never see my kids except for when I send them off to school to an overcrowded classroom and when I kiss them at night because I'm working two jobs to put food on the table. They deserve better than that, and they deserve better than Duncan Hunter.
Okay, so let's talk specifically about healthcare, which yes. really is the defining issue, yes. I think, of this election more than any others, although there's certainly a lot that are important. Mm. What I hear a lot when I speak with people out there who are, I really regardless of party, is that people are frustrated that mm-hmm. on the one hand, you have Obamacare that did get health care mm-hmm. for an awful lot of people, and it protected us from being kicked off for pre-existing conditions, let us keep our kids on our plans. It did a lot of good things,
right.
but it certainly wasn't perfect. A lot of people in the middle are paying maybe more than before. People in the 50 to 60 five range are really getting hurt with higher premiums in some cases. And yet on the other extreme, so on the one hand, we have Democrats who as a party have pretty much said, Obamacare, great, right. leave it alone. And on the other hand, Republicans saying, repeal Obamacare, but we really don't have anything better. In mm-hmm. fact, our plan is mm-hmm. going to kick even more people
right.
off.
Right.
And depending what state you're in, some states you might be okay. In other states, you know, you're really up to the whim of the governor and the legislature for what kind of health care you're going to mm-hmm. have, or if you're mm-hmm. going to still have access to Medicare and mm-hmm. all these different things. So having worked in the Obama administration mm-hmm. and learned presumably a lot about health care,
yes.
what do you see as, number one, the ideal solution? If you mm-hmm. could wave your magic wand, mm. what would your answer for healthcare be?
Yeah.
And secondly, what's the pragmatic approach?
Right.
You know, assuming you go back and Congress hasn't, you know, magically flipped 100%, what's really realistic that might be able to be gotten through that would improve healthcare instead of making it worse?
Yeah, I think that's a great question. And for me, I was very vocal. I've been vocal about, you know, I worked in the Obama administration, but I certainly did not agree with everything that was being done. Mm-hmm. I was against TPP. I was against
which was the Trans-Pacific Trade Agreement.
That's right. I didn't think it was fair trade. Mm-hmm. And the reason I didn't think that is because we have this thing called trade adjustment assistance. Mm-hmm. And that helps people who have been down to luck, lost their jobs as a product of trade. And I found that we were investing a lot in that program, which tells me that our current trade policies were failing.
Yeah. So.
So on trade, that's one thing. On healthcare, the Affordable Care Act did good on care. It did not do good on affordable. We are still the most expensive healthcare system in the developed world. And what we need to do is address this issue pragmatically and as fast as possible. Mm-hmm. What I want is single-payer healthcare. What I think we need now is a system, and I've thought about this a great deal, that expands Medicare for folks who are 50 and older, that allows them to buy into the system at a very modest cost.
Very good idea. So when you're between 50 and 65, I'm certainly in that range. I'm one of those people that suddenly seen my cost of healthcare go through the roof, although I've been needing more care like most older folks do. Mm-hmm. That seems like a wise idea. If you can't afford Obamacare with no subsidies because your income is just a little bit too high, and in California, you know, we still have high housing costs and utilities and everything. Mm-hmm. I think a lot of people in the 50 to 65 bracket would say, you know, I can afford to pay something. It doesn't have to be free, but I can't afford, you know, a healthcare premium that's as much as my mortgage is, which under both private plans and Obamacare, some people are finding that they have to pay. So
that's exactly
to me
right.
Seems like it would be a pretty good idea.
And the beauty of it is that all that money would, and Medicare would go mainly towards services. They're not mm-hmm. for profit. Mm-hmm. And that means the more money you put into that pool, the lower the services are for everybody, because you just broaden the base of people buying into the system. And that what it does for everybody else who's not buying into Medicare is it forced the free market to compete with that broader Medicare system. So it drives down the cost of the free market so they could compete for those people who are 50 and older. And otherwise, they're going to be outcompeted by the Medicare system that's become more broad.
Yeah, and of course the Medicare is very much like VA. Really, they
That's
are
right.
healthcare for all systems. It's just
That's
limited
right.
only to people
That's
of a
right.
certain age or and or people who've served in the military.
And I've talked to veterans who have said, I'm going to vote for you, Amar. I've talked to veterans who voted for Trump who said, I'm going to vote for you because you want healthcare that I had in the military. Mm-hmm. And single payer was plenty good for me as a military service member. Mm-hmm. It should be plenty good for me and my family and my fellow citizens, even as a veteran. So they're for single-payer healthcare. They're for expanding Medicare.
Yeah, and you know,
it's
interesting for people that don't know this. When the House voted through this Trump care bill that repeals Obamacare, it's interesting if they thought Obamacare was so bad, mm-hmm. why did they exempt themselves so that only members of Congress
right.
will get to keep
That's
it
hypocrisy.
If the Senate passes
That's
it?
That's hypocrisy. And I think we need to send somebody to Washington who will not be corrupted by the ways of Washington. And I think my time in Washington, the fact that I'm coming back and giving back mm-hmm. and still pushing these values shows that there's someone in this race who has been in Washington who will not be corrupted by the ways of Washington. And I think that is the most important thing in our next member of Congress, because we've had plenty of Congress members who brought national shame
yeah.
to this district on both sides, Democrats and Republicans.
Yeah, Randy Duke Cunningham and Bob Filner come to mind,
That's
don't
right.
they? Along with
That's
now
right.
Duncan Hunter, who is, of course, under a federal investigation, Department of Justice investigation for mm-hmm. alleged campaign finance, well, we know there are campaign finance mm-hmm. violations, but for allegedly using $60,000 mm-hmm. worth of campaign donations, including public money, this is public matching funds here for federal campaigns, for personal gain, you know, for trips for him and his family to
right.
Europe and various other
right.
expenses, flying his son's pet rabbit first mm-hmm. class. And
which would be funny if it wasn't so sad,
yeah,
right, and shameful. And while he was out there doing that, I was fighting for people's health care in the White House. I was helping small businesses start and scale their businesses at the Hispanic Chamber of Commerce.
Mm-hmm.
And I was helping people in this district who I've met with mm-hmm. punch their ticket to the middle class and beyond at the Department of Labor with good paying apprenticeship jobs.
So let's go through some of the other issues beyond health care. We've mentioned veterans a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
Duncan Hunter, of course, is a veteran mm-hmm. himself. He's fought and been in both the Iraq and Afghanistan wars. And so mm-hmm. we certainly thank him for service to our country.
Of course.
But do you believe he's done enough to stand up for military personnel and veterans?
I don't think he has, and not just because what I think. I've talked to veterans who are concerned, who know that AHCA is going to hurt veterans and hurt their livelihoods. And so I know for a fact he hasn't done enough. And I've talked to veterans and I've sat with them and I've told them, you know what? I have seen war myself. I was born in San Diego and I grew up in a war zone. And I told them, and I said, I'm here not to campaign, but I'm here to say thank you. I was at a VFW. And I told them, I know what war is like and I wouldn't wish that on my worst enemy. And the fact that you knowingly, willingly go into that arena to lay down your life so that someone like me has the freedom in this country, that you fight the wars we wage abroad so someone like me could have the freedom to fight the wars we wage within, is something that I could never, ever repay.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where my passion comes from, because I know there are people who have literally laid down their lives to give me the freedoms I have, to fight for income inequality, to fight for healthcare, to fight for people's rights in this country. And if it weren't for them, I wouldn't be here. They went first so someone like me could stand here today and tell you that I'm running for Congress.
Yeah, that's very, very passionate. Let's move on a little bit and speak about immigrant and refugee issues and this whole issue of mass deportation. But I'm wondering first, I heard you speak at the candidate forum recently in East County, and you spoke very movingly about your own family story and how that has influenced your life and your views on these issues. I wonder if you could repeat that for our listeners.
Absolutely. So I was born and raised here in San Diego, and my mom was both mom and dad for most of my life. She really raised me through a broken heart, through being broke, and eventually made it in real estate and is providing for me and my brother, or at least was until I, you know, became a man. And she knew that she felt like her two boys needed a father. So we went to go be with my father in the Middle East for a couple of years. And during our time, war broke out. And my father is somebody who came to this country a couple years after his parents were killed in front of him.
In front of him. So he witnessed.
At the age of 11.
Wow.
You know, if you look at that kind of a thing and you look at the fact that here's a young orphan who lost his parents in the Middle East.
Yeah, tragic.
Tragic. And it's the kind of profile that you see that is the perfect target for terrorist recruiters to take in.
Yeah.
And he chose at a young age, and I'm not sure how he had the mind for this, but he chose to reject radicalism and embrace peace despite what he had seen. And he chose, after going to different parts of the Middle East, he chose America, and thank God America chose him.
Did he come here as a refugee?
He came on a student visa, and he studied here. He opened up a few businesses in San Diego, had two sons. One of them just got accepted to UCSD and the other one's running for Congress. So I really do believe that arc, that American miracle, is something that a lot of people who are suffering want to have. They want to be able to fully and fairly contribute to our American way of life.
Yeah,
and
you really
economy.
Have lived the American dream. So what are your views then on these Trump executive orders that would severely restrict immigration, including even refugees fleeing war and persecution in the Middle East?
You know, I think that the Constitution is very clear, and you cannot discriminate against a whole group of people based on their ethnicity or their religion.
Which two judges have so far said.
Yes. So I am against the Muslim ban. I am against Islamophobia. I'm against anti-Semitism. I'm against every kind of prejudice and bigotry of all kinds.
What are
including, I might add, some of the rhetoric that I hear against the white working class.
Yeah.
And I really believe that people from my part of the political spectrum look at conservatives and they think they're ignorant. And I really think that a lot of them are ignored, especially in the conversations I've been having with them. They're not out of reach in terms of being able to speak to them, but we can't speak at them. We have to listen to them. And I've talked to a lot of Trump supporters who, when I talk to them and share my values, it resonates with them. And so they just need someone to listen to them.
East County certainly has a very high rate of rural poverty, and there's also a lot of poverty in El Cajon. I believe 24% or so of people in El Cajon
One in three children are in poverty and alcohol.
Yeah, it's terrible. And in some of the rural towns, it's actually even higher, but they don't count it town by town because of the way that the census is done. But we know from looking at the schools that when you have 65% of the kids in some schools on the federal school lunch program, that these households are in, are in poverty.
Right.
So it is, in a lot of ways, it's a lot like the, you know, the Rust Belt and some of those very red areas in the Midwest that went for Trump and people didn't understand why, but I think out here.
I do. I understand why.
Yeah, it isn't just a bunch of bigots or something.
It's not.
Where do you stand on the border wall and what we should do with the 11 million undocumented immigrants that are in our nation?
I think we need to secure our country. I think we need to secure our country even especially for those who are escaping persecution from other parts of the world. The last thing people who are refugees who are seeking asylum need is to be terrorized in this newfound country of theirs.
Right.
So as someone who had a father who came to this country and migrated here, I'm concerned about people's safety from people who have been fleeing persecution.
That's happening a lot now in Central America and parts of Mexico where people are fleeing the cartels. Yes. They're being threatened with death. And then there are others who are simply economic refugees where they just can't support their family and they come here to be a farm worker or work in the hotels or other industries. Some of them have been here many years.
That's right.
Most have been law-abiding. And yet, they're being threatened with deportation, and a report just came out that showed that the majority of those Trump has deported so far actually were not serious criminals. They either committed no crime at all, or it was only traffic crimes or minor traffic infractions or fairly minor things.
Right. And that's wrong. I mean, we've also deported a lot of veterans, people who've laid down their lives, who've earned the right to be an American, and they get deported, and they don't get to come back home. They do get to come home when they die, and we'll have the full-on military funeral for them, and we'll honor them, and we'll fold the flag, and we'll present it to their parents or their family members. And that's an injustice to our veterans.
Yeah.
And that applies to a lot of people who have come to this country who have earned their citizenship, I believe, by contributing fairly and fully to our economy and way of life. And when I wholeheartedly believe that we have to protect our border. I don't think we need a wall because we don't live in the Victorian era, and we have a more feasible and fiscally responsible way to do that. Instead of spending billions of dollars on a wall, that won't work, and I'll tell you why. Because 40% of people who are here undocumented overstay their visas and they fly over here.
Yeah.
So unless that wall is 60,000 feet in the air, it's not going to solve nearly half of the problem.
Very good point.
And so how do we take that cost and shift it towards Medicare? And shift it towards our veterans and shift it towards infrastructure so that we could have roads that lead to rural America so businesses could invest in those places.
Let's talk about business and labor issues. Now, you worked for the Department of Labor and you've also worked for the Hispanic Chamber of Commerce, which is very interesting. I think it's rare to see a candidate who has a strong background in both business and labor and so who could maybe see both sides of the issues. What, in your view, are the ways to turn this economy around and help a lot of the people that are either unemployed or underemployed in low-paying jobs?
Yeah, and what I've noticed in this district is a lot of people are self-starting people. They're bootstrapping people.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of people want to be self-employed. They want access to credit, capital, and contracts. So how do we make sure that we streamline the process for small businesses to thrive and flourish?
Mm-hmm.
Small businesses create 2 in 3 new jobs in this country. So they are the engines of economic renewal.
Right.
So how do we do that? And I have ideas of how we could streamline it with the SBA and get them to be able to compete. But here's my driving theme. For me, this campaign is about solving economic injustice, regardless of your views or your hues. I don't care what you look like or what you believe. If you're Republican or Democrat, I believe pain is pain. And what I've learned at the Department of Labor is I think this is the most critical thing that I want to talk about.
Okay.
We created 16 million jobs in the past 8 years.
Mm-hmm.
We lost 5 million at the heat of the recession. That means we have 11 million net new jobs. The facts are just the facts. Half of those jobs went to Latinos.
Mm-hmm.
More jobs were gained than lost by African Americans. And more jobs were gained than lost by Asian Americans. the only group that did not gain back the jobs they had lost were the white working class. They
Very
still have a deficit of 700,000 jobs. And the reason that is, we have to explain why to address the problem mm-hmm. and fix it,
sure.
is because businesses will invest in places that a majority of people could drive to, fly to, or get to on a metro.
That's not going to be the coal mining towns.
That's right.
In
that's big cities that are more densely mm-hmm. and diversely populated, which is why you see diverse communities benefiting from the job gains. But we also see that the African-American community has 27% poverty.
Yeah.
The Hispanic community has 26%. The Native American community has 30%.
So they're getting jobs, but they might be very
right.
low-wage
right.
jobs.
And so there's joblessness on one side and poverty on the other.
Yeah.
And all of it's economic injustice. How do we solve this problem? There is a program that we did at the Department of Labor, and we worked with the Department of Agriculture to bring coding jobs to rural America.
Ah.
And there's a lot of different groups, and where there was one program called From Coaling to Coding.
Interesting.
And it's a program that lifted people's lives. There's a man in Kentucky, I believe, that Secretary Perez, now the DNC chair, talks about, and I was there. He talks about how there was a man who lost his coal job. He learned how to code through an apprenticeship program. He makes around $60,000 a year now, which is double the median income, mm-hmm. which is above poverty, which is what we need.
Is that something that would be practical for
yes.
some of these small rural towns in East County that have no mass transit, high unemployment, high poverty rates?
I do. And the reason is these coding jobs, if they're able to do it in remote, isolated third world countries and ship those jobs abroad,
why can't we do it here? Yeah.
We could do it here.
Mm-hmm.
And instead of having someone have to uproot their lives to go to a big city to get a job and drive 2 hours
yeah.
for that big city job, we could actually bring the big city job to people in rural America. I've seen it with my own eyes. And
Very
we've
good.
Actually done some of that in this district. So if I'm elected, I'll use that experience to help people get jobs. And I really do think that economic stability is the mother of all solutions.
Yeah.
I think it will reduce the tensions that we have between communities. And if we could lift up everybody's lives and reduce everybody's pain, we could move towards a path towards a unified future. And I know I could do that. And
yeah,
I think
a lot of that scapegoating is very often really because somebody's so down on their luck
right.
and they're out of work and they're looking for somebody to blame and it's that immigrant or that newcomer. But really the problem is the economy and the fact that we've lost the factory jobs, the
mm-hmm.
general dynamics, the places that people used to be able to work, no matter your race. And like you say, rising tide lifts all boats.
Right.
So.
And here's, I think what I want my role to be as a Latino Arab, what heartens me the most mm-hmm. is when I see people who are not in my community fighting for my community. And
yeah.
the reason I'm running is because there are people who've been fighting the good fight longer than I've been alive,
mm-hmm.
who aren't from my community, so I could be here today running.
And you've mentioned you've been active in your church in helping mm-hmm. some of these causes, too.
Right. But my point with that is I think that the white working class needs a fighter who maybe isn't from that community, who could say, I understand what you're going through. And there was a gentleman who came to me and said, look, Amar, you don't understand. I worked in a factory that my dad worked in until he went to go fight the War of Normandy, and my mother worked in that factory for the first time as a woman, building the tanks and planes that followed him there.
Yeah.
This isn't just a workplace for me. It's a place of worship. It's a national monument. And that place is gone because somebody far flung across the world could do my job for cheaper. How do you explain that to me?
Yeah.
And how do you help me resolve the fact that I feel uncertain about welcoming immigrants to do more of that? And so I have a conversation with them.
That goes to the issue of trade. You've mentioned to me that one of the few issues mm-hmm. where you agree with Duncan Hunter and his father before him is on the free trade issue.
Mm-hmm.
Can you explain what you think about things like NAFTA and the TPP?
Mm-hmm. Well, when it comes to agreeing with my opponents, I think a broken clock is right at least twice a day. So I'll give them one. And I do think that we need to make sure that people who have been working, especially in the past 8 years, are part of the economic recovery that they help build. And a lot of people have had lost their jobs, lost their homes, lost their livelihoods, about to lose their health care if we don't get it together. They are left behind in this robust economic comeback. And we have to focus on them. And that means having fair trade agreements that make sure that they aren't losing their jobs because they created an economic condition that now stacks the deck against them.
Let's talk about education. Mm-hmm. What are your views on education and specifically the Trump administration's policies toward that?
Yeah, I think it is sorely misguided policy. I think the quick answer is public funds should go to public schools.
You're not in favor of the Betsy DeVos method of let's give a bunch of money to charter schools, which, by the way, a lot of people don't know. She was heavily invested, you know, millions, if not billions of dollars, her and her husband, in a charter chain that promised online education. They've been in trouble all over the place for having an absolutely terrible record of poor graduation rates and just not doing a good job of educating the students.
So why would we invest in that when 80% of our kids go to public school? And they, you know, they have parents like the one I told you about who never sees her kids, and the kid is going to an overcrowded classroom, and that's pretty much the adult interaction this kid has. How is that rearing a child for a successful life? We need to invest more in our teachers so they could teach better, they could mentor better, they could be better adult figures in the lives of these kids, and also make sure that there's more one-on-one engagement with fewer students in classrooms.
Do you have ideas for making higher education more affordable and accessible?
The Obama administration, again, they've done a lot of things that I didn't agree with, but they were moving towards trying to make community college free. And I think that's a good first step.
It used to be in California.
Yeah, that's right. And so vocational programs through community college is one way for people to have the skills they need to get good jobs. And I think we could look at ways to modernize our government. Here's one thing that really frustrates me. We get new iPhones given to us every year, and we still have a government that gives services to taxpayers from technology, based on technology that is 50 years old.
Yeah.
And you feel it every time you're at the DMV or you're getting your VA benefits or you're trying to get a small business loan or a mortgage. If we streamline that process, we would have a lot more funds to orient it towards other programs like education, like making community college more affordable, like making college close to being free.
And what about student debt? For those who've already been through college and are now saddled with this tremendous student debt, they're even attaching people's social security. You retire and you haven't been able to pay that loan off, and and they're coming after it.
I'd like to see what other countries do. I'd like to see something like a GI Bill, but like a civilian bill, where you go and you do some community service for a couple of years, you pay your dues to society, and you get that debt relief and you get that loan forgiveness. I think we could do that.
Okay. Let's talk about energy and the environment, and also let's lump climate change in there. First of all, do you believe in climate change? And if so, what should we be doing about it?
I don't know. Let me ask you, if we get 10 billion tons of carbon out of the earth every year and emit it into the air, do you think that we're contributing to climate change?
Absolutely.
I would think so. Mm-hmm. And what I think is climate change is not just an environmental issue. It is a healthcare issue. It's a national security issue. Syria's civil war broke out because of a drought.
Yeah, that's true. And also, the more reliant we are on oil from the Middle East, the more dependent we are on countries like Saudi Arabia.
And the more involved in their conflicts we become.
Yeah,
so
exactly.
I think if we want to become more independent, which I want our country to be more independent, I think we have to invest in our own sources of energy and once again be what America is, which is a pioneer.
Yeah. How do we balance? On the one hand, obviously things like solar and wind are clean and green in the sense that you don't have factories belching out, you know, black smoke full of pollutants or nuclear waste that could last for hundreds of thousands of years where you have to worry about where you store it and what happens if it leaks. But that said, in East County, we have seen a couple of wind projects out here where they created a lot of issues, bursting into flames, starting fires in our fire-prone region, shining lights in people's windows, falling over multi-ton turbines that just collapsed onto public trails and things like that, or where there was infrasound and noise issues. Do you think that when we're looking to site alternative energy projects, that there should be some changes in the rules to allow consideration of not just wind here or wind projects somewhere else, but maybe saying, well, wind, but maybe what about an alternative of, say, if you're talking about Ocotillo, what about if the alternative was putting solar on a bunch of roofs out there, investing the same amount? We actually did the math on that one, and they could have put solar on the flat roofs out in El Centro for a lot less money and not, you know, had 500-foot tall wind turbines next to a state park and around a town, you know, where a lot of people objected to it.
I think that that makes a lot of smart sense, and we need to have an all-of-the-above strategy. And look, whenever you try to have these big overhauls or transitions or transformation mm-hmm. and the way major sectors work or the way we do things in this country, there are going to be some false starts. That shouldn't dissuade us from trying to move towards what we know is the right thing to do. Can you imagine if when we first had the New Deal and if Social Security just didn't work, we had some hiccups and we just stopped trying? Or if we stop trying to have Medicare, or if we stop trying to build infrastructures or railroads, right. or if we just stop because America, just the idea of America was just too tough.
Right.
That is
the first automobile didn't get good enough mileage.
Exactly.
Or something.
Or if just the Wright brothers said, you know what, flying a plane is hard. Let's just stop now. Like, I think this is the same way our posture should be towards the energy of the future.
Right.
And I think we need to put ourselves in a position where American business and American workers can outbuild, outcompete, and outgenerate our global competitors mm-hmm. to keep America first.
Yeah, that makes sense. And at the same time, like you were saying with the rural people who weren't being respected on the right. jobs issues, you know, respecting their wish to keep the towns beautiful and pristine
right.
and listen to their concerns right. on some of these things.
And so if they don't want wind, they want solar, we go with solar. If solar is less invasive in their life, then they've spoken. The free market's spoken. They want solar. They don't want another invasive means to alternative energy. And mm-hmm. the beauty is there is more than one selection to pick
exactly.
from.
Exactly. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense to me. I'd like to speak a little bit about the investigation into Donald Trump, his administration, and these alleged Russian ties. Now, Duncan Hunter, your opponent, was a very strong supporter of Donald Trump from early on mm-hmm. and has continued to support him and not support an independent prosecutor or any real investigation into Donald Trump. As we're taping this, word has just come down that Trump fired the FBI director, James mm-hmm. Comey. The supposed reason is because of the way he handled Hillary Clinton's emails, although Trump himself praised that at one point and was, you know, exhorting his crowds to lock her up and everything.
Mm-hmm.
And suddenly he's decided this is a reason to fire him.
Yeah.
Coincidentally, just a couple of days before Comey was supposed to testify before the Senate Intelligence Committee about the progress of the investigation into Trump's Russian ties,
mm-hmm.
which Senator Feinstein, who's been privy to some of this information,
right.
has said is a lot broader than the public has been led to believe. The speculation, of course, is that Comey was about to maybe spill the beans on some things or was getting too close to things, perhaps, that mm-hmm. the Trump administration didn't want out. So they fired him. Now, the New York Times, the Washington Post, have quoted a lot of legal experts, a lot of them saying that this sounds a whole lot like Richard Nixon mm-hmm. firing Archibald Cox, who was the Watergate special prosecutor when he started getting a little too close to things Nixon did not want to be made public. So I would like to ask mm-hmm. you, if you were elected, would you support a special prosecutor, and how concerned are you about the potential that A, Russia may have hacked our presidential election, and B, that Donald Trump may have perhaps known or been complicit in that?
I'm deeply concerned about that. And of course, I would want to make sure that we have a full review of what happened.
Mm-hmm.
I think, you know, I'm not privy to the same information that Feinstein is, so I don't want to speculate and fuel the fire. But I think no matter who the president is, they have to be subjected to the full scrutiny and have to have complete transparency. And a lot of people don't feel like this administration has had that.
Yeah.
You'll remember that Hillary Clinton sat there for 11 hours. And took it.
Correct.
I think anybody who's trying to seek high office, and especially when they are in that office, has to subject themselves to the full scrutiny and full transparency of the law. And the most defining question of our time, I believe, it's not if our institutions will protect us, but will we protect our institutions?
Mm-hmm.
And we have to step up, we have to step in, and we have to make sure that we hold power accountable, whether it's big government or corporations. We have to make sure that the most powerful voice is the voice of the people. And no matter how powerful you are or think you are subjected to the full scrutiny of the people until we find it satisfactory to whether or not this investigation has panned out and is clear and that he is thought to be without charge.
Yeah, you would think that if he was innocent of all of this, that he would want and welcome the investigation mm-hmm. to prove that. And yet, you know, they seem to be doing everything they can to obfuscate.
And that is concerning. So I would call out to President Trump to let the process go as it should. And if you feel like you are not guilty, then the best antibacterial is sunlight.
Sunshine, yeah.
Right. So I think we should just let the process play out and let the American people see what it is. It's a tough job.
Yeah.
And I've been subject to scrutiny, and I'm just running for Congress.
Yeah, speaking of that, mm-hmm. I always like to ask congressional candidates mm-hmm. who are, you know, getting some traction out there. I see you're starting to get some national press and mm-hmm. so forth and a lot of local coverage. But who are your primary backers, including your financial backers?
People. I don't have a single corporate dollar. And we've raised a good amount of money. From what I've heard, we're in the lead. And the reason is because I have campaign handlers who say you should be spending 6 hours a day making phone calls to funders.
We should mention that there are at least seven candidates,
right.
Democrats alone, running against Congressman right. Hunter right now. We've heard there may be as many as 12, but at least seven right. of them have come out in forums right. and spoken.
And so when my team says you should spend 6 hours a day, I spend maybe 12 hours a day not doing that, but talking to people in their homes, in their town halls, at VFWs, listening to what they care about. And because I listen and because I'm willing to learn, they're saying, I think you're capable of leading and I'm going to help you fund your campaign. So that's where my money's coming from the people I'm spending most time with. Not big donors, but ordinary folks.
What makes you believe that you're strong enough to win in a field of at least seven Democrats as well as running against Congressman mm-hmm. Hunter, assuming he's still in office then mm-hmm. or whoever the Republicans mm-hmm. put up, and if you're elected, to withstand the pressure from lobbyists back in Washington, D.C., and all those special interests?
Right. Let me answer the second question first. Mm-hmm. I'm the only candidate who's running who has gone to Washington and not lost my way. And that is not true for any congressman that we've had in the past generation. If you talk about the Hunters or Bob Filner or anybody else, they go to Washington, they lose their way. I've been in Washington for 5 years, and I haven't lost my way. I still talk about the working class. I still unapologetically talk about single-payer health care. I still talk about climate change being the worst calamity that we have to face. And I will continue to talk about that until my dying breath, because I believe in that, and I will not be corrupted. The way I think I could actually win this district is through that sincerity, talking about issues. Pollsters got 2016 wrong.
They sure did.
On paper, I might not make sense in this district, mm-hmm. but with people at the pavement, in tailgates, with Trump supporters that I talk to, I am hearing from them and they are telling me, I voted for Trump, but I like your style because you listen and you learn.
Yeah, I think that that's something that both Donald Trump and Bernie Sanders had in common this mm-hmm. election. Both of them were perceived as sort of, you know, feeling the pain and listening to real people and not towing any party line, mm-hmm. certainly. And both of them really confounded the pollsters in how well they did. So I think you're on to something with that. Mm. A lot of people have complained about Donald Trump as being a misogynist, not only on issues such as wanting to slash or eliminate reproductive rights for women, abortion, birth control funding, for example, even access to it, but also things like opposing the Fair Pay Act for women and, you know, signing some of these things that restrict women's rights in the workplace, even during Women's History Month
right.
and Equal Pay Day and so forth. What are your views on women's issues?
Well, I believe that women are the better gender because my mom was my mom and my dad. And I wouldn't be the man that I am today were it not for her. And the idea that someone like her doesn't deserve the same rights or the same amount of pay is insulting to me. Because my mother raised two boys by herself, and she deserves equal pay for equal work. And you know what? A lot of people believe that. Once you lift the political ideology, I was talking to a Catholic Trump supporter. I spent an hour and a half talking to him. And he said, you know what? I love what you're saying about jobs and the economy. I love what you're talking about free trade. I love how you talk about the white working class suffering like everybody else. Mm-hmm. But where do you stand on abortion?
I think almost everyone would say they wish there were fewer abortions. It seems the difference really between Democrats and Republicans very often, or religious folks and mm-hmm. everybody else, is how do you do that?
You know, we had this conversation and,
you know, without restricting women's rights.
Right. And I told them, look, I'm Christian, but my job as a congressman isn't to save a fallen world. There's only one person that can do that. My job as a congressman would be to increase opportunities and reduce suffering. And I asked him, do you think a majority of people actually want to have abortions? He's like, I don't think no one willingly wants to go into doing it. It's not
right.
a fun experience. So we had a baseline of agreement. And then I told him, okay, well, what do you think causes someone to make that very difficult choice? And we talked about things and we agreed that it's a narrow set of circumstances that puts people in that position.
Yeah, actually, they polled women who had them, and the number one reason given was economic. They simply felt they couldn't afford to have a baby. And then most of the rest of the cases were where it was either a severely deformed mm-hmm. fetus or mm-hmm. mother's life in danger or something else. And very few of them were just,
exactly,
so to speak, convenience.
And I asked them, what if we gave women equal pay? What if they had a living wage? What mm-hmm. if they did public works, if they had yeah. a prevailing wage?
Healthcare. You know, it's easy to say someone shouldn't have an abortion, but if she doesn't have insurance and it's going to cost her $40,000 right. to give birth to a baby that she would maybe give up for mm-hmm. adoption, mm-hmm. that's an awfully big ask.
And so we started talking and we started building that trust. Because mm-hmm. we talked about the Bible. We talked about our faith. We talked about yeah. caring for the least of these. We talked about what you've done to the least of these you've done to me.
So you would take a compassionate approach yeah. to trying to reduce right. abortion.
And I think the best way to do that, we were talking about, don't you think we should broaden the lane of choices?
Mm-hmm.
And he said, I think if you make more choices available for women,
yeah.
you would reduce the likelihood of them having an abortion. I said, so wait, are you pro-choice? He's like, no, that's not what I'm saying. I said, I think you are. And we kept talking. I said, don't you think if we had more education and more information and more resources for yeah. women, they wouldn't have to make that devastating decision that they don't make lightly?
Right. And as well as access to birth control. I've always
right.
thought it terribly ironic that often the same people who say they're against abortion and want it outlawed don't want women to have access to birth control
right.
to prevent an unwanted pregnancy.
Right. And then I told them, well, what about in the case where if the mother gives birth, she dies? And this is where
yeah.
it really became difficult for
yeah,
me.
Yeah, I've had personally two friends who had to make that choice.
Wow.
You know?
And I asked them, and this is where we have to listen.
Mm-hmm.
I asked him, I said, this is a gotcha question. For sure he's going to say, the mother lives. You know what he said? The mother has to die. I said, why? He said, because her soul is saved. The child hasn't been baptized yet.
Hmm.
And I was like, that is a point that is so out of reach for me.
Yeah.
How do we continue to talk?
And yet it's his religious belief, but not everybody would believe this. You know,
right.
anybody's free to make that
right.
choice. And if they're religious, they right. can make that choice for themselves.
And I was,
but should they be able to make it for other people who may not think the same way?
And that is a valid point. And for me, the conversation ender is, you know, we don't want government forcing people and dictating what individuals, especially women, choose.
Right.
But for the sake of this conversation, I said, okay, well, what would you want me to do as a legislator? I can't end all abortions. I can't do that. I don't have the means to do that. But what I can do is reduce it.
And even outlawing it, we should note, doesn't end them.
It doesn't.
Women will still get illegal.
Exactly.
Illegal ones are just more dangerous.
Right. It harms two lives now.
Mm-hmm.
So what I told him, I said, what would you want me to do? You know that if we got rid of Planned Parenthood, it would actually increase the number of abortions because we wouldn't have the education and the resource and the contraceptives to prevent unplanned pregnancies. So I told him, what would you want me to do if I voted? And he heard what my value system is. He learned to trust
yeah.
what
so
I was saying.
So what did he say? I'm curious.
He said, I asked him, now that we've talked about the fact that if you brought in the lane of choices for women, they're less likely to have an abortion. He said, I would want you, and these are his words, to do the lesser of both evils. I would want you to vote to fund Planned Parenthood.
Very interesting. So really a lot of this may just be about educating people a little bit about the real consequences of
that. I think it's not about education. It's not about the truth. It's about trust.
I see some parallels here. You know, you talked about it being partly an issue of how much do we want government involved in lives. And really, it's a little bit like the gun control
mm-hmm.
issue, isn't it? Where there's Second Amendment rights to be balanced versus, you know, protecting people from some crazy person with a gun. So I should ask, what are your views on the Second Amendment mm-hmm. and gun rights or gun control?
I was talking to a gentleman who's a veteran who obviously was in the military, and I pointed at one of his guns, and I said, this gun, did you have it in the military? Did you have a gun like this in the military? He said, yes. I said, what did you use it for? He's like, for war. I said, so it's a military weapon. It's an assault rifle. I said, you're not shooting deer with this, are you? He's like, and he laughed. I said, well, my point is, how did you acquire this weapon the first time? He said, well, I had to go through a robust background check. I had to get a mental fitness check, and I had to have a review every couple years to see if I was still able and equipped to handle this weapon.
Mm-hmm.
It's a weapon of war. I said, can we do that for everybody as civilians? And he said, and I said, can we do that in a way that doesn't make you feel like your rights are being infringed upon? And I told him the Second Amendment really was born out of the idea, if civilians have to take up arms to overthrow a tyrannical government, if they have to become militarized citizens in the event that that happens, if that's really what you're concerned about, don't you think they should go through the same rigors that you went through while being in the military? And he said, yeah, I do support background checks of that fashion. And I said, okay, do you think that's infringing on your freedoms? He says, no, I just don't want anyone to take my guns away. I said, well, what about ammunition? Do you think anyone should have 1,000 rounds of bullets? Because a gun doesn't kill anybody.
It's you don't really need that many to go hunt a deer.
Yeah, exactly. It's the ammunition that does it. And he said, you know what? I think that's a valid point. We might not have to need infinite ammunition. If you want more ammunition, you should have a more robust background check. But yeah, if you don't want to take away my guns and the way you want to do it is just like see to it that, you know, I have to go through more of a background check to get more ammunition, that's fine. But I like my guns and I want to pass them on to my kids.
Yeah, so basically it sounds like you support the Second Amendment, but in the strict interpretation that you believe the Founding Fathers intended it.
That's right. And also we have to just make sure that the guns aren't getting in the hands of the wrong people. It's a public safety issue.
Okay. Listeners, if you've just tuned in, we've been speaking with Amar Kampanajar, who is running against Congressman Duncan Hunter in the 50th Congressional District. Amar, I want to give you the last word here. Is there anything else that you would like our listeners to know today that we have not already asked you about?
Yeah, I just want to talk to everybody in the 50th District. I've been out there speaking to all of you from different political backgrounds, and what I've learned is that you just want someone who will listen to you, someone who will bring national pride, not national shame. And what I've learned is you care about the issues. You don't go to work and do your job with the letter R or D on your forehead. You go as an American who cares about your family, and you want someone who will fight for you. And I know that this election, it's not just about electability, it's about accountability, it's about responsibility, and most importantly, it's about trust. People get fixated on the truth, who's right and who's wrong. It's about trust. And what I'm going to do is start with trust. I believe the path to the truth is trust, and I'm building that with different people from all walks of life. And regardless of your views or where you come from, you could find a home in this campaign, and you better believe I'll be fighting like hell for you if I'm elected congressman.
If people want to learn more about you or get in touch, where can they get more information?
Yeah, if you want to get in touch with me, you could go to my website. It's campacampaign.com. And if you want to email me, I'll give you my personal email, even though my staff will probably won't like it. It is amar@campacampaign.com. I'd love to hear from you. I'd love to buy you some coffee and talk about what's on your mind.
Very good. I want to thank you so much for joining us today on the East County Magazine show on KNSJ, the Network for Social Justice.
Thank you.
You're listening to KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, broadcasting from the desert to the sea.
This concludes today's episode of East County Magazine's radio show. We extend our appreciation to the Heartland Coalition, our parent nonprofit, and to KNSJ 89.1 FM, broadcasting from the heart of East County and Descanso. We extend our appreciation to our sound technician, Liz Alper, and to our producer, Miriam Raftery. We also thank the musicians who provided music for our show, Laura Preble, Jim Hannibal, Corey Clement, Giovanni Galicia and the Smashing Beats, Donnie Gentile, Wooden Ambulance, Dusty Summer Road, A.K. Jules, Brian Boykel, Royalty Free Music, Frank Nora, Blues 3 Music, and Pond 5. If you have story ideas or would like to underwrite the East County Magazine radio show, please contact editor@eastcountymagazine.org or call 619-698-7617. We'll be back soon for another edition of East County Magazine's radio show.